As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Brent Gunning here, Sam McKee alongside me. Boy, tonight's a fun night to talk about the Blue Jays, and we'll do a little Blue Jays talk for you before we give way to Sportsnet tonight. We'll be here with you until midnight. Yes, quick little one-hour show from us tonight. Blue Jays are 11-4 winners against the Yankees. Joining us now to discuss tonight's game and, well, all things Blue Jays is Kevin Barker. Barks, how you doing tonight?
Hey, boys, what's up?
Well, what's up is Alejandro Kirk. He is the new guy that everyone can't seem to stop talking about in Blue Jays land. Why wouldn't they? What a night from him tonight. Are you at all surprised? We know there was a lot of, I mean, we're all surprised it looked like this, but there's been a lot of buzz around this this prospect. Now he's up here. What did you make of his night?
Yeah, the 4-for-4, obviously, we didn't see that coming. You know, I didn't expect him to see him hitting 96, 98-mile-an-hour fastballs as hard as he was hitting them. That's the issue all year with the Blue Jays lineup is, you know, not being able to do that. To have a guy hitting in your 8-hole that can do that, can drive the ball line to line, it's a big deal. I love where he stands at the plate. You know, he's 5'7", so he has to create some bat control and bat to be able to get the barrel to the baseball, and he's standing a little bit closer to the pitcher. That he allows him to lay off some breaking balls, and he got the head out. He's hitting the ball hard, right? He's a pretty good receiver behind the plate. Doesn't have the greatest of arm. We saw that. He throws from his knees. You know, he one-hopped the second baseman, so that's not his strength. His strength is hitting the baseball hard line to line, and if he does that, it'd be real hard not to play him a lot.
Yeah, so I got to ask you, Kevin. You've played it for a lot of teams over your years, you know, minor leagues, major leagues, everywhere. Have you ever seen a body like that?
Yeah. I've seen a lot of bodies like that. Not ones that can hit a baseball like he can. You know, right. It's, you know, he's perfect with the way he looks to be a catcher, right? He's low to the ground. He's a big target behind the plate. You know, he gives the pitcher an early target with his glove. He sets up early and you know, he puts the fingers down firmly and aggressively, which is a big deal again, right? He's a pretty good blocker. Like I just mentioned, he's not a very good thrower. So, you know, you don't expect a whole lot from that. But if he sticks with a game plan, you know, Pete Walker and John Snyder, they give him a really good game plan. If he sticks with that, you know, he's not going to be too bad behind the plate, but he is back there because he can hit. You know, the catching situation all year with the big leagues with Danny Jansen and whoever else they put back there is not, you know, producing whatsoever offensively. If you get a guy like this that can give you something that will add a little link to your lineup, again, how do you not play him more times than not?
Well, and that's exactly the thing. You kind of mentioned it there with Jansen. It'd be different if he was a kind of game changer defensively or you really loved the way he calls a game. And I don't think any of us are kind of pouring dirt on him in those regards. He's a young player. I think he could still kind of develop those traits. But because Jansen's not able to kind of give the Blue Jays that you know, certainty back there, I think it makes it easier for Kirk to play. I just the thing I always kind of have to remind myself about is we see this a lot of times with guys who come up and have hot starts to their big league career. And, you know, I just worry if the Blue Jays find themselves kind of counting on a guy who, look, we all love what we saw tonight, but there's definitely going to be an adjustment made. Do you worry at all that this guy becomes too much counted on for this team?
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, he's going to hit eighth in your order. You know, if he can hit a fastball one time and four at bats and maybe drive in a run, that's what you're asking for. This is what they do at the big league level. They attack you early in your career with fast stuff. You know, the fastballs. They'll move them all over the plate, in, up, away, and then they're going to start flipping them. The word's going to get out that he can hit a fastball, and now we're going to find out if he can hit a breaking ball. And that's, you know, that's just what you have to do as a big league player. If you want to stay in the big leagues, you got to make adjustment. But I will say this again, him being 5'2", 5'7", and where he stands at the plate, he stands a little bit closer to the pitcher, allows him to see breaking balls a little quicker out of the pitcher's hand. Maybe he's a pretty good breaking ball hitter. He seems to not strike out a lot. You know, in A ball, if you don't strike out a ton because all those pitchers there are hard throwers, they have no idea where it's going. Obviously, he's got a pretty good eye at the plate. He understands seeing breaking balls out of hands. So if he just walks up and doesn't try to do too much, you know, and they don't overuse him, don't overexpose him, hey, why not? You know, this might be a nice little surprise here in the last 10 games that he could run out there and maybe give you something offensively.
So we all know Randall Grichuk's been struggling, Kevin, but tonight he looked like he had a pretty good night at the dish. You know, he had a walk, nice home run, a couple runs batted in. Anything different you see from him tonight, or is it just kind of him coming out of that slump that he was in?
Yeah, you know, again, I say it's about time, right? This is what they paid him for, was to stay right center to left field line. I know he loves to, every time somebody sticks a microphone in his face, let the ball travel. Let the baseball get deep. Yeah. I know, obviously, you don't do that, but mindset will tell you he's trying to go, you know, line to line. He's not that guy. You know, last year, I keep trying to tell everybody, he hit 31 home runs and drove in 80 runs. Why all of a sudden are you trying to reinvent yourself as an older player and trying to hit 25 points higher? Me, personally, him hitting fifth in your order, I don't want that. I want him to hit 30 and drive in 80. If he hits 250, I'm okay with that. So this tonight was a good sign because it was free and easy. He got the foot down. He wasn't thinking about anything. He got the barrel out in front of the plate a little bit. He stayed through it. He hit a home run to right center. Let's back that up, because tomorrow he's going to need this confidence to go in. He knows what he's getting. He's going to get fastballs elevated, middle away, and up. If he does exactly the same swing he took tonight into tomorrow night, he'll probably have the same success.
Oh, sounds like it would have been a good day for Alejandro Kirk, but I don't know if we'll see him going back to back there. I do want to ask you a little bit about the starter we saw tonight, Matt Shoemaker. Obviously, there's a lot of questions about where he kind of fits in from this team. I think you have to be relatively pleased with what you saw out of him tonight. Do you think he kind of showed enough to kind of force his way into the discussion for maybe even that third starter spot?
Yeah, I think he's already in there. Yeah, I said to, on Baseball Central today, he needs to go fastball, four-seamer in with the split finger with some late bite. That's exactly what he did. He sprinkled in some sliders and some curveballs. He would throw those 0-0 to maybe steal a strike, but he was mainly in with some fastballs. The velo was even up. We saw 96s from him. I've never seen him throw that hard. He was adding that. He would elevate it, and then he would throw the split finger. He's very confident in that. What was it, 52 pitches, three innings? Next time he goes out, it'll probably be 75 pitches. If he can work in five innings that way, for me, he's lined up for the third start. Who else would it be? I think that's what you have to ask your question. Now, obviously, they got to get to the third game, but if there is a third game, you would think him and Robbie Ray are piggybacking, and that would be a nice little combo, right? You're getting a right-handed power guy with a splitty, and you're getting a left-handed power guy that can mix it all around the plate with a slider. So, you know, if they can get to a third game, that's a nice little combination in my eyes.
All right, Kevin, last one for me. And this, not to be too critical in a night where the Jays scored 11 runs and, you know, got a nice victory that they needed. But if Wilmer Font can't get three outs in a 9-run game, what are we doing here, Kevin? Like, that? Come on. Can you not get those outs? Like, okay, man, oh, man.
Wilmer Font's the same guy all the time. He throws five pitches. You know, he's a bullpen guy until he learns how to simplify it and say, I'm a four-seam 98 guy with a slider. That's real simple, but he wants to reinvent himself and throw three different fastballs, two different off-speed pitches, and then it's real hard to find release points because, obviously, he's a bullpen guy, and to control five different pitches is impossible. It sometimes will amaze you that a guy continues to do the same bad thing over and over again. For me, he's got great stuff. Somebody around him needs to say, hey, You got a great fastball. Throw it and then expand with a secondary pitch. Throw strike one, and all of a sudden you might be a high leverage guy. But the way he's pitching now, it would be really hard to go to him when it matters.
Yeah, especially after what we saw tonight. Somebody we love to go to when it matters is you, Barker. Thanks so much for the time tonight.
There we go.
You got it. Have a great night, everybody.
There he goes, Kevin Barker, joining us a little later than I think we all expected tonight. We had fun watching that, but boy, these games are dragging. Yankees, they love a long ball game. Boy, do they love it. There are a few things anyone in all of sport loves than the Yankees love playing four-hour, nine-inning ball games.
Yeah, and are there any, like, Brett Gardner, is there anything that guy loves more than to grind out an AB down 11-2? Just, you know, guy, like, wouldn't even consider a swing at a pitch out of the zone, which I guess as a Yankees fan, you gotta love that his ability to grind out an AB, no matter the situation. He's a winner. All he cares about is baseball. But man, maybe just take a cut at one of those high heaters out of the zone. That'd be nice. Brett, could you do that for us so we can get on 25 minutes earlier, man? Like, good Lord. But the Yankees have always been like this. Every game against them, it doesn't matter who's wearing the jersey. It's always been their approach. It doesn't really matter who's managing. It's just always been the exact same approach. They always, always grind out ABs, and tonight was no different, Gunnar. But good win for the Jays. You know, things got dark there for a little while last week in New York, and then blowing that big lead against the Phils in the second half of that doubleheader. Then they get that nice win against the Phils yesterday, and they have this one, get some mojo going so that they can sort of look towards a playoff spot and start to get playing well to getting in there, you know?
Well, you talk about Brett Gardner, and there are only two people in the park who apparently wanted that game to keep going, and it was Gardner and it was Wilmer Font, and they were both doing the Paul Rudd look at us meme as the ball game is still going on. The umps calling everything within a foot a strike. The amount of very polite questioning of the strike zone by Dan and Buck on the call tonight. Well, that certainly. Could have been a strike in other games. Like, it was clear as day. It was time to go home, but not for Brett Gardner, not for Wilmer Font. Obviously, Blue Jays actually able to hold on and get it done. But yeah, as you mentioned, it was so nice to kind of get back to what we saw from this team earlier on. Obviously, not every night looks like this, but I mean, think about it. Like, even the Alejandro Kirk, like that was just such a shot of fresh air to a team that so sorely needed it. Like, just think about how you pretty much had the exact opposite feeling going against this Yankees team the last four times you played them. And now it's just, I mean, I was doing a show with Wonger on Saturday morning, and it was, will the Blue Jays still make the playoffs after being swept by the Yankees? And wow, it's amazing how different that feels just 4 days later.
Yeah, and it really helps that the Toronto Blue Jays have a poo-poo platter of teams chasing them. So, I mean, like, it really, really helps the situation that no one is going to really push them at all, because they have the Mariners behind them, they have the Angels behind them, who are all extremely bad baseball teams. And the Jays are better than that, but, I mean, like, this was always the argument, right? This is what we always said for the Blue Jays, that, you know, they're a good enough team. They have guys, they have a better pitching staff, which, you know, that's been not necessarily completely true over the last little while, but, you know, they're obviously their lineup's been a lot better. And guess what? The AL stinks, and we were all right about that, because it does stink. And there's no one that's a legitimate sort of team that's sneaking up on them and is trying to, you know, ruin this sort of Cinderella run by the Jays to get into a playoff spot. But I hate to tell you, if the playoffs were to start today, Jays are heading down to the old Trop. Wouldn't that be fun?
Ooh.
Boy. Like, I thought we were done with them, but here we go again.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, that's been a house of horrors forever, and you've actually had some semi-decent results there, it feels like, in the past, this shortened season and going back to last year as well. You finally kind of, you know, got the monkey off your back a little bit there in that park. But it's like, yeah, that's kind of the, I feel like every other team you can kind of talk yourself into. I mean, if you, let's say you ended up playing the Yankees, you'll remember what last week felt like, but you also look back to tonight and you've actually played them decently. And obviously you want no parts of Gerrit Cole in a series, but it just feels like the Rays are kind of the one team you definitely want to stay away from. I do want to pick up on something I asked Barker about there, and I tend to agree with them. Matt Shoemaker is kind of the third starter if you need one. I think the fact they could have Robbie Ray to kind of piggyback off of him, I'll be honest, initially when Merriweather went down today, that was kind of a concern for me with regards to that, because I felt like he would have been another guy to kind of, not as the starter, but as the kind of second guy out, the piggyback guy. What about for you? Does it make sense? I mean, obviously, hey, you'd love to get the series taken care of in two games and not need to worry about it. But if they need three starters, is it as simple as Ryu, Walker, and now Shoemaker, or is there somebody else for you?
No, I think that's how it goes. And I'd like to see them stretch Matt out a little bit more in his next start, because I think they were mentioning on the broadcast that he's slotted to start on Saturday against the Orioles. So I'd like to see, because how many pitches did he end up throwing tonight? Probably around 50 or so, right? So he didn't push it too far. So I thought he looked sharp. I thought he looked like Matt Shoemaker out there, you know, with the sort of the hard biting stuff. And like Bark said, the heater that was up there touching around 96, which is surprising for him. And I thought he looked good. So he's not a guy that's going to go out there, you know, and pitch a complete game shutout and blow everybody away. But he's a guy that's going to give you a chance in a playoff game, right? Like, he's not going to go out there and completely blow up, and you're not going to be out of it in the first inning of a game. So he's a type of guy that I wouldn't mind seeing. Maybe even stretch him into the fifth inning and then maybe do the... Barks brought up Robbie Ray there, and I love Barker, but man, that is, scares me a little bit. So I wouldn't be convinced with Robbie Ray in a playoff game. Let's just say that. But I think the Jays have sort of positioned themselves with enough of these guys that they can kind of patch their way through it. And it all depends who you use in the other games, right? It depends if something else happens, but I would like to see them use Hatch for a couple innings. He's been excellent. Baraki's been excellent. They have guys that are sort of these molded from starter into bullpen guys that have a little bit of an ability to go a little longer. Maybe not more than two, but definitely have the ability to do two. So I think we can all agree that the Blue Jays bullpen's great as long as old Fonzie doesn't come out. And if old Fonzie comes out, then she goes downhill in a hurry. But I've been really impressed with what I've seen from the Jays bullpen, and it looks like they really could have they have a chance in the playoff series. But I guess we would be remiss to not mention Ken Giles today if we're mentioning the bullpen, which is a huge blow, not only for the Jays, but personally for him going into free agency. That's a tough, you know, and now he's going to have to work his way back and prove himself again, and that closer lifestyle is a tough one. So just thoughts for Ken Giles before we move on.
No, absolutely. I think that's a good point to bring up by you. And I think the one name maybe we didn't mention in all of that conversation is Nate Pearson. He's the guy that I think is going to be really interesting to see where he kind of folds in. I mean, if you're looking at, okay, Shoemaker's going to get you through the first three, maybe four innings, if they want to still keep Pearson kind of in that, you know, he's not going to have a starter's workload, but if they want to keep him in that starter's mindset and start him fresh, clean, with a fresh inning, he'd be a great guy to pick back off. Or I've loved the idea potentially of kind of using him as a almost high leverage Hatch if you need somebody for 7 and 8. I know that's a lot to put on a kid, but I feel like he's just gonna, his stuff when he comes back, if he is healthy, and that obviously he won't be back if he isn't healthy, but his stuff is just gonna be so much more sharp and so much more electric than any other guy you have in the back there. It's gonna be so tempting.
No doubt.
Like, how are you not going to use him in a big spot in the 7th or 8th? That's the guy that I think is the most interesting thing. And I think that's also kind of why Jays fans are so curious about it, because if there's one thing we've asked ourselves a lot this year, it's why did Charlie do that? Or why is that Charlie's decision? And so just having it so up in the air, we've talked enough about that. We talked a little bit about this guy with Kevin Barker, but I mean, we just have to sing the praise of Alejandro Kirk. What have we done? Like, it feels like we've gone way too deep into the show without singing our own praises. I have not enjoyed watching a player this much because, again, it's the mixture of low-ish expectations with the, absolutely smashing through them tonight. I got to give credit to both of our buddies on Good Show. I don't know if it was Ben or JD who came up with it, but me and you are absolutely both Alejandros. What a night for him. And, you know, I guess the actual kind of discussion point question to come out of it is, how much do you see him? And, you know, I joked to you on text earlier tonight that Danny Jansen looked a little nervous pacing the dugout, wondering how many starts he's about to lose. But, you know, I don't know how much of an honest question that is.
Yeah, so I guess game one, it's crazy, you know, that we're talking about this, but game one of a playoff series will be Ryu, right? And Danny Jansen and Ryu have been doing it together all year. And you would imagine that he would get the start in the first game of the whatever that's called, the wild card series,
the round.
I guess, of the 2020 COVID Dome baseball series. I don't know what the hell they're calling it, but the first round. So then you'd have him start, and then you would probably go back to back Alejandro Kirk, right? Because his bat is just significantly better. And I know Danny Jansen's having a tough year, and the offense was sort of supposed to be the highlight of his game, I guess. But from what I've seen, Alejandro Kirk is much, much more hitterish than Danny Jansen is. He just has a better looking, he just looks better at the dish. I mean, because he's a power pot roast at the dish, he looks like a bowling ball up there. That adds to the allure for sure. But he definitely is more of a threat. He's a hitter. Like, this guy, every level he's ever played at, he's hit. And guess what? He's come up here and he's hit. So I am convinced he's hot. It's a short season. press, you hit, you just ride the hot hand. And I think he's a hot hand, man. And boy, oh boy, did Sportsnet, like, could our broadcast crew be any better? We have a World Series broadcast crew every single night, and then they give us the Kirk cam of him sprinting around the bases from, like, above. And I was like, this is – you give the people what you want, Sportsnet. You get to listen to Buck and Shulman call baseball games, which is just so brilliant. And then you give them the Kirk cam of him just steaming around third base. I tweeted out that he looked like a bowling ball going down a freshly waxed lane. He just looks so good out there. I love Kirk. I'm an Allahan bro through and through. I'm thrilled that he's doing so well, so because we get to watch him more.
The only downside, and you mentioned it, tremendous broadcast tonight. I know they had the charity auction going on throughout the game. It really felt like after that moment, there needed to be a Kirk package to be bid on it at some point in time. I'm throwing it out there. Hey, look.
A virtual meet and greet with Alejandro Kirk.
A virtual pot roast with our favorite pot roast, whatever it is, who knows? But I mean, it felt like a missed opportunity. We're both idea men. We both often are saying, get me in a room with this people. Well, here, I have my pulpit, so I'm using it to pitch all my ideas. In all honesty, great job tonight. I believe all the auctions have wrapped up, but a great, great job as always by the broadcast crew.
For sure.
And as we said, great job. If we're going to wrap up Jay's talk tonight with any one thought, it's got to be, great job by Alejandro Kirk. We are definitely Alejandro.
You're here.
Great job by the Blue Jays tonight. We'll see if it goes as well tomorrow against Garrett Cole. A little bit of a tougher test, but Blue Jays picking up a win to open the series against the Yankees. When we continue, we'll have Sportsnet tonight. Going to talk a little golf. Yes, it's me and Sam. You know we got to get into the U.S. Open. Lots of NFL thoughts, NBA. Busy, busy show. There's only 40 minutes left. Well, we'll fit it all in somehow. Sportsnet tonight, next.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Tonight, Brent Gunning here, Sam McKee alongside me. We'll be here with you until midnight before we give way to a kick in the grass. Dan Riccio and Jeff Blair will have you covered with all things in soccer. But right now, we're going to have you covered with the U.S. Open. Joining us now to discuss it all, Drew Stoltz, co-host of Gravy and the Sleaze and the Subpar podcast. Drew, always love having you on, and it's not just because you have maybe the best Twitter handle in golf, at the Sleazy Man. Drew, how you doing today?
Oh, doing fantastic, boys. Nice to be back on with you boys.
Yeah, great to have you on with us. So we'll jump right into it. Bryson winning. I mean, I think we all kind of saw this coming at some point in time. We knew it was going. You know, we knew it was in the cards that he could be a major winner. Obviously, with the pedigree he had, and then just the kind of, you know, the gains he made on and off the course this year. But you know, where do you like? Are you at all surprised that his first major win doesn't just come in getting it done, but it comes in an evisceration of the field? You know, it's the 8-shot win. It's the beating, you know, the only guy to finish under par. Are you surprised he was able to do it in such a dominant fashion?
I'm not really surprised that Bryson won by the margin that he did, but I'm surprised that he won at the golf tournament, that he did it at a U.S. Open. If you look at what Bryson's doing right now, you can't really argue against it. Since he's come back from COVID and the restart, he's been an absolute beast, right? He's won. He's finished in the top 10. He had his best major championship finish at the PGA. So what he's doing is working. But for so long now, we've been told, like, the U.S. Open is the one place where you have to put the ball in the fairway. You have to be conservative. You got to hit greens and do everything. And Bryson took that old motto and basically just threw it out the window and said, no, you don't, dude, because guess what? I'm going to hit driver on every single hole that's humanly possible, and I'm going to take my odds doing it that way. And I think the fact that he did it at a U.S. Open winning by six, because really – that would be the one venue, the one golf tournament on the entire schedule where you would say, no, this wouldn't work. I think most people have Augusta National circled as the place where, like, yeah, I want to see Bryson ball out there. You got big wide fairways. You got no rough. You know, he's an incredible putter. That would be the place that you would think Bryson ball would do well. Not a winged foot, but not the U.S. Open, and especially not at a winged foot. So that's what really, I guess, kind of surprised me. Because I'll be honest, I had my doubts going into the week. I was like, yeah, I don't know if you can get it done around winged foot, just blowing driver everywhere. But he did.
So, Drew, where does that final round kind of rank in terms of, like, maybe not the all-time great performances, but it's got to be up there. With those conditions and sort of the not winning going into the final round, he was trailing heading into the final round, and to sort of just smoke Matthew Wolf and to kind of just separate himself pretty early on in that, where do you think that ranks? Because that was a really, really impressive round of golf.
Oh, man, it was unbelievably impressive. I mean, when you look at Wingfoot that final round and you look at the average scoring, there was one guy in red numbers at the end of the day, and that was Bryson DeChambeau in the final group trying to win his first major. I mean, it doesn't really get much tougher than that. You know what I mean? I've heard Wingfoot catching some flack because, like, oh, man, minus six shouldn't win a U.S. Open. You know, we were hoping maybe it would be more like 2006 when Jeff Ogilvie won and plus six won the golf tournament. But I think the golf course setup did its job. It identified the best player in the field, which was Bryson DeChambeau. And scoring-wise, if you eliminate Bryson DeChambeau from the leaderboard, it looks exactly what you would think a U.S. Open leaderboard would look like, right? Nobody under par. Even par would have been the winning score. It just so happened that Bryson was out there this past week. And I think that we're putting way too much emphasis on his driver, right? Like, he's bulked up. He's swinging it hard. He's got 190, 200-mile-an-hour ball speed. He didn't even lead the field in driving distance this past week. If you watch the final round, Matthew Wolf was hitting it past him more often than he wasn't, right? So, like, I think we're putting too much emphasis on what Bryson did with his driver and not giving him enough credit for what he did with his putter and around the greens. He was, like, in the top 10 in strokes gained in both scrambling and in putting. You put that together with also being one of the longest drivers out there, and that's a pretty good formula. But I think we're putting too much into his driver and what he's doing, because there are other guys that can hit it pretty close to where Bryson's hitting it right now, but none of them were even close as good as he was from that point forward. From his approach shots on, Bryson was spot on, and you can't just win a U.S. Open by hitting it long, and that's not why he got it done. But that final round, man, I mean, that was so impressive. It became a match play situation pretty much after the ninth hole. Nobody else was within distance, and Bryson put his foot down and just he handled it incredibly well. I thought it was an unbelievable final round.
Yeah, that's a good point you make about the driving distance. Like, he's definitely long, and he's freaky long, and I also would like to thank you for bringing up that he wasn't the longest guy, because that gives me a chance to pub our own Canadian, Taylor Pendrith, who is leading at least after the first three rounds, I know. So thank you for giving me that chance.
Canadian bomber.
I guess my thing about Bryson is there's been a lot of talk of, oh, this is the kind of new way to play, and he's really showing people the blueprint, and I think that's true. But I also think what he's done is incredibly difficult. And there's been a lot of talk about, oh, he put in the time in the gym, but I think we kind of overlook exactly how much time that is. Like, I'm sure there will be some guys who will, you know, gain muscle and put on mass and chase speed and all of those things, but I don't know that anyone's going to be able to do it in quite the fashion that this guy has been able to.
Yeah, I mean, what he did, it feels like this is an overnight thing, right? Because, like, you know, we saw Bryson, and then we had COVID, and then we had 3 months off, and then all of a sudden when golf started back again, here was a different Bryson than we'd seen the last time. So it feels like it was overnight. But we actually had his swing coach on, Chris Como. We actually had him on Gravy in the Sleeves today, and we were talking about it. And he's like, dude, this has been a long time coming. This wasn't an overnight thing. The amount of time he's put in the gym, what he puts into his body, how much energy he spends every single day working on strength, not only strength, but like speed and those type of things. Also taking care of his body, making sure he doesn't get hurt, you know, trying to play golf like this. He's done so much that you can't do anything but tip your cap, because he's trying to do things that really no one's ever tried in the game of golf before. He's got the single links golf clubs, right? When he came out with that, people thought he was crazy. Well, guess what? That worked.
Still kind of do.
It is a strange thing. I don't think I could ever do it, but it's working for him. He tried side saddle putting for a while, and the USGA said, nope, you can't do that. So he said, okay, boom, I'm going to go up the arm. I'm going to lock it up the arm. He's not afraid to try different things. And say what you want about whether you like him off the golf course or has he done some stupid stuff on the course since the restart? Absolutely. Some pretty bad PR stuff. But you got to give the man credit for having conviction in his ideas and going about things a different way and how quickly it has worked for him. Because when he came back from – that's so much change in such a relatively short period of time, and it's already working. We've already seen him in the two majors we've had this year. He's got a win and a top 10. You know what I mean? Like, it's working, and it's working everywhere. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so, Drew, I have to say that I was not the biggest fan of him kind of heading into the pause, but just the transformation of the game and just – like you've been talking about, I just respect the hell out of the guy's work ethic. But having said all that, how hard must it have been for Matt Wolf to watch him grind these putts when he's up six strokes. Like, I know that's the process. I know that's what's got you there. You have to stick to it. But, man, Matthew Wolf must wanted to put his putter through his head that whole back nine.
Oh, I'd be like, dude, you're beating my brains in. You're going to win the U.S. Open. I want to get off this golf course. I would just like to wrap up second place and get this thing done. Stop grinding on everything. But we talk to these guys right after they win major championships. We're like, at what point did you know that you had this thing won? And to a man, pretty much no matter how big the lead, they're like, dude, once I hit it on the green on my second shot on 18, like, I knew I was good. Like, these guys, there's no quitting these guys. There's so much weird stuff that can happen in golf. You just never know. And in this world, like, they don't take anything for granted. So Bryson has this elaborate process that he goes through with his caddy and everything. And I'm really not surprised that he didn't change anything down the stretch. It's like, dude, keep your head down and you can pop up when you're hoisting that trophy at the end. I also thought it was weird that Matthew Wolf didn't putt on the 72nd hole before Bryson, because, like, pretty much status quo is if the guy's going to win a golf tournament, you don't have a putt to, like, win or tie. You get the hell off the green and let the guy have his moment. But, you know, Wolf opted to mark and let Bryson go first from just a few inches behind him. I thought that was a little strange, too.
Yeah, I agree with you. That was a little weird because it was so anticlimactic. After Bryson hit that putt with that phenomenal reaction, sort of timing it with it falling over the lip of the cup and him putting his arms in the air, and then it's like, and now Matt Wolf for his birdie.
That and now Matt Wolf pushed for birdie, which doesn't matter for anything. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
especially if there was fans there, dude. Like, the common courtesy is like, let me get out of the way, and whether you make this putt or miss it, like, it's your moment after that. So it's a little different without fans, but still, that's kind of the unwritten rule.
For the first time in all of the post COVID golf, the first time I missed the fans was when Bryson hit that putt. Because that would have been, some people don't like Bryson, some people, whatever, there's a lot of different opinions about the guy. But that's like a U.S. Open clinching putt on 18 where he puts his arms up in the air and the fans in the background with the New York fans who are nuts. I feel like that was the first time I actually really missed the fans.
Dude, I'm totally with you. For whatever reason, I didn't notice it or care as much about it at the PGA for whatever reason. And maybe it's because it's been so long since I've seen Harding Park host a major golf tournament that I was like, I didn't really remember there being fans there, right? But Wingfoot, I can immediately remember back to Phil in 2006 and what went down and all that. And then New York fans in golf are they're unbelievable. And I know a lot of people don't like Bryson. That's totally fine. But New York fans do appreciate, like, good performances and winners. And say what you want about the guy personally, but that performance he put on this week at Wingfoot was special, and there would have been a massive ovation, especially the way he cleaned that up on 18.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just think back to the last time we were at Bethpage and the fans were getting all over Brooksy. And yeah, it's incredible. And that's kind of exactly what we like to see. What we love tonight was this chat with you, Drew. Thanks so much for the time tonight. Really appreciate it, man.
Absolutely, boys. Appreciate you guys having me on here anytime. And keep up the good work.
There he goes. Thanks, Drew Stoltz, co-host of Gravy and the Sleaze and Subpar, the podcast. Anytime I can have a good golf chat and you'll let me sneak in a little Taylor Pendrith mention, it's a good day.
Buddy, I got a couple quick more thoughts on the U.S. Open. So proud of Taylor Pendrith. You know, like, I can't say that I watched one swing of golf of him this weekend. They didn't show him a whole lot. Let me tell you, the U.S. broadcast didn't get a lot of his swings. But for him to be the low Canadian, that's just such great bragging rights for the boys. Be like, I thought you guys played in the PGA Tour. Like, I just went out there and shot a 70 at Wingfoot on Sunday. Like, I thought you guys were supposed to be good. So that's great for him. I'm really thrilled about that. And I will say that during the broadcast, the moment that I really was really happy for Bryson, and I talked about this with you guys, a couple of buddies in the text chain that I have with you, they showed that video of him at Wingfoot at like 10 o'clock on Saturday night before, like, right with the lights on, and he's just blasting drivers. He said on Saturday his driving was pathetic, and he goes out there till 10 p.m. with the lights on at the range and just hits driver after driver. The guy wants to be great. He demands greatness. He's a bit of a weirdo, kind of a Trump lover. Like, there's definitely reasons to hate him, but man, oh man, I respect his grind, and I respect what he's trying to do. And, God, he's hard to watch putt. But those are my final thoughts on Bryson.
quickly. I'm just going to give you this is an edited list, and credit where credit's due. No laying up. Great golf Twitter feed. You can follow
phenomenal
there.
Stuff.
Here are just some things Bryson did this year. Gained a million pounds. Became the longest in the game. Fought some ants. Made a 10. Called out Kepka's abs. Cooked bacon shirtless. Said he wants to live to 130. Yelled at a cameraman. Had his caddy block a cameraman. Berated a rules official. Won the U.S. Open. And then here's two I'm just going to include. You mentioned his 10:30 range session after the third round of the U.S. Open. And I would like to mention earlier in the year when he had his caddy holding a towel over him while he was at the range so the sun would not affect the lasers he uses to measure the distance he hits the ball. This guy is incredible for the game. You don't have to like him. I often don't, but boy, it's great that he is a major champ. There's no great athlete, I think, that I fluctuate more, not day to day or week to week, but honestly moment to moment while watching them, Bryson.
That's a great point, and I just want to quickly touch on Matthew Wolf. That was full meltdown mode. He started out really good. He really did. They were kind of battling, and I honestly think the turning point was when Bryson hit that eagle putt. And I know that Matthew Wolf hit his after, but that was just like Wolf was probably like, oh my god, like I can't beat this guy today, because he got the eagle, it got him to 5 under, and then that got Matthew Wolf to 4 under. But I just think mentally that was such a huge putt for Bryson. And then he just started hitting shots and looking at his caddy like it was his fault. I was like, oh yeah, he's definitely in full meltdown mode now. I know that one. Look at the golf bag, blame the air. Like, he was just, so he's not ready for that moment, I don't think. I think, hey, you know what I'll say about Matthew Wolf? I think he's going to have more chances, because I think he's a really great golfer. But there's a reason that guys that age don't really win the U.S. Open that often, because winning the U.S. Open, it's a different kind of pressure, especially on a Sunday like that, at one of the most famous courses in the world, one of the hardest. And boy, oh boy, that course, what a beautiful, amazing track. That is a big-time bucket list course, like a top, probably top 10 in the world kind of track that is just unbelievable and great for championship golf. And I like to compare number 10 at Wingfoot to the famed number 10 at Lakeview, right beside the clubhouse. I know you love that comparison.
Yeah, and we'll be playing it tomorrow morning. That's right. It wouldn't be Sportsnet tonight with us if we didn't discuss our own golf games. But in all honesty, you mentioned Wingfoot. We both said we were happy to get to know it a little better this week. I think we both did. It was a great major venue. We were happy to see it. And here's what else is great. The next time they play a major, Tiger Woods will be the defending champ at a November Masters. Boy, all of that sounds really weird to say, but I love 2020 now.
Buddy, what's the tournament this weekend? Our boys, Matt Hughes, is the second favorite. You see that? I don't even know what it's called.
It's the Putacana Corrales Resorts Championship, I think. Probably not. Something along those lines. But yes, Hughes and Connors, both up there. Luckily, it's not the Puerto Rico Open, so whoever wins it won't be cursed. Who's not cursed? Producer Mark Boffo. He's going to join us, kick around a bunch of topics. The NFL's a thing. We haven't even mentioned it. Shame on us. I think we'll rectify that next. Sportsnet tonight.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet tonight, Brent Gunning here, Sam McKee beside me. Want to thank our technical producer tonight, Danielle Furtado, and of course, our producer, Mark Boffo, everybody who joined us. Well, everybody but two people, Kevin Barker and Drew Stoltz, the best Twitter handle in the game, at the Sleazy Man, joined us to talk a little bit of U.S. Open. Of course,
and the best golf takes in the game.
He was red hot. We'd only chatted once with him. I thoroughly enjoyed him buttering us up ahead of time with always love talking to you two. That makes me feel, you know, if you pump my tires and make me feel like a man of golf, it's just going to predispose me well for the interview. But now I bring in our very illustrious producer tonight. Really had to grind away to put together this just marathon of a program we've had. Mark Boffo on the line. I hope we're hungry. I certainly am. Boffo, how you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. Yeah, short but sweet tonight, but always a pleasure to join you fellas.
Yeah.
Let's get started tonight with the NFL, since that's what you brought up before heading to the break. And let's start with the local team here, the Bills. They're 2-0, but Cam Newton, guys, has also looked pretty good with the Patriots in the first two games, despite the loss last night against the Seahawks. Has the AFC East champion been changed after your first two games this season? Do you think the Bills can still overtake the Patriots, or have the Pats given you some pause?
I said from the start of the year, Boffo, that Cam Newton and the Patriots were going to win the division, and I got to tell you something. I have seen nothing to make me feel any differently about that. I just absolutely love what I've seen from Cam Newton and the Pats. I just think he's just added such a wrinkle. I think Josh McDaniels and Belichick are just licking their lips every time Cam goes out there. They're doing all these weird little gadget plays. Probably should have thrown it on the goal line yesterday, but other than that, I think they're loving having Cam. And I said before the year they're going to win the division, and I'm going to stick with that, boys. I really do.
Quickly on the end of that game last night, there was no way they were throwing it. Belichick, it was just like there's too much mind jujitsu going on. It's like, will this team throw on the goal line between Seahawks and Patriots? It's like there is about 37 layers of chess happening in that move. I was very intrigued by all that. I actually am a little bit surprised, not by what I've seen out of Cam, but what I've seen out of the Patriots kind of as a whole. The fact they were able to hang with that Seahawks team last night, I think that really kind of solidifies them. It kind of proves what we saw from them in week one. I think the Bills have actually been a little better than I would have expected. I've been saying all weekend on this station that Josh Allen's a guy who's going to fluctuate somewhere between the 7th best quarterback in the league and the 25th, and boy, last week he might have been better than 7th, so I have to tip my cap to him, but I still think the Pats probably find a way. It won't be a lot, but I think they'll be one game better when it's all said and done.
Russell Wilson's pretty good, eh?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, no, geez, he's something else. I mean, when Bill Belichick is saying he's the best there is right before you face him, I think that says something. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens when the Bills and the Patriots square off against one another, but I'm with you guys. I don't know how Cam Newton didn't end up with a job, and how he's paying or how he's playing on the minimum salary right now. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Let's move on to the NBA. And speaking of things that don't make sense, I don't know what's up with the scheduling. The Heat and Celtics played Saturday and won't play Game 4 until Wednesday. So ask me how they have 4 days off or whatever it is. That's a little crazy. The Lakers and Nuggets are back at it tomorrow. No offense to all the Jamal Murray supporters and all of the Lakers haters, but you know, I don't see any way LA loses this series. My question to you guys is, what makes a better final? An all LeBron matchup of Heat versus Lakers, new team with the former team, or just a classic Celtics-Lakers rivalry? We won't have it on the parquet. It won't be at Staples Center either, but it's a classic rivalry nonetheless.
I'll jump in first. First things, great job by you, Boffo, just shoehorning a take into that question. I thought that was very well done of the Lakers are absolutely getting through. And then I like agree. All of the Heat-Lakers storylines. I think it's fun. Jimmy Butler really getting a chance to prove himself, but it's so far and away Lakers-Celtics. It's the franchise matchup, but then it's also the closest thing you get to a team that you think is young and on the rise, kind of trying to take down the old established superstar. I think that's the kind of best kind of passing of the torch type finals, if you will. Plus, I just think you have a little bit more star power with the Celtics there. So give me Celtics-Lakers.
Yeah, I think that Celtics-Lakers, obviously for all those reasons you laid out, plus if the Lakers just wear their yellows and the Celtics just wear their green, all the games that they play together, it's just such an aesthetically pleasing jersey matchup. I love when those two teams play. But that's just a jersey nerd part of me. And I think the Lakers have a better chance to beat the Heat than the Celtics. I think the Celtics are a really good team. I don't know. I think they just match up better against them. Celtics scare me. They're not down and out against the Heat. I think they're going to come back and beat the Heat. I think they're a really good team. Maybe it's just my Raptors PTSD, but I think that I don't know. Something about the Heat and the Lakers matching up, I just feel like LeBron would bully them, but there's just some storied stuff, some voodoo with the Celtics, with this like an old storied team that's won a bunch of championships. I just feel like it's different. So give me Celtics-Lakers, but if I want LeBron to win, give me Celtics. Give me Lakers-Heat.
Well, it is funny you kind of mentioned the matchups, because both teams actually kind of set up well with them when you kind of look at it in specific ways. If you want to look at Boston, it's like, well, we obviously know LeBron's on the wing, but other than that, that position's pretty weak for the Lakers. And then it's like, wow, Tatum and Brown can really kind of go to work there. But then conversely, you look at the Heat and it's like, is there a kind of defensive tandem better set up to, you know, you don't stop these guys, you just slow them down or make them work. But, you know, Butler on LeBron and then Bam on AD. That's a great matchup there. So yeah, I think either way it'd be really fun, and you could kind of talk yourself into either team having a really good chance against the Lakers, I think.
I just hope LeBron wins. I just want LeBron to win the championship.
Here. I completely agree.
Add to that trophy case, buddy. Drive up the greatness. We want to see it. So let's go LeBron. We're all in on LeBron here. We're all LeBron guys. Right, Boffo?
Yeah, no, right. I'm with you guys. I was just going to say, just on top of it all, too, just, you know, with everything that happened with Kobe and that tragedy, I think the Lakers winning this year would be fitting. I'd like to see it. Quickly, guys, last one from me. Just going back to last week, kind of under the radar, but not really, was Manny Malhotra getting signed as the Leafs' new assistant coach. You know, a defensive forward, face-off specialist. What do you think of the new hire? Can he bring some intangibles to the blue and white?
Can he play on the fourth line? Defensive specialist, face-off guy. Oh my God, give it to me. That's right. Would you not want to slide him right next to Spezza right now on that fourth line?
Yep,
oh boy,
I do.
Give him the Freddie Goat role. I don't care if he's 50 or however old he is. No, in all seriousness, I think it's a good move. I think it's somebody who has a lot of respect throughout the league as a guy who's coached, as a guy who's played, all of those things. And also, this is no knock on this person I'm about to mention. He's not Bruce Boudreau. And that was just a problem kind of waiting to happen. I think Gabby is a great coach, but I think the idea of having a ready-made replacement sitting there waiting in the room, that's a bad idea. I think Malhotra kind of checks a lot of the similar boxes that you could have got bringing in a guy like Boudreau, but you kind of remove the drama element. Again, not that I think he'd even be doing anything to stir it up. I just think it's asking for it. It's like living with an ex-girlfriend or something like that.
Yeah, we'd be steering out the drama. Don't worry about that. So here's what I'll say. I absolutely love that he left Vancouver to come to Toronto. That just warms my heart that he just said, you know what, I'd much rather go coach the Leafs because no duh. And second of all, I saw all the responses on the tweet when the Vancouver Canucks tweeted out that he was leaving. And I got to say, they were all extremely upset that he was leaving. So, you know, I usually gauge, and if a fan base is that sort of engaged and knows that much about an assistant coach, he must be doing something good because, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll be better at face-offs. Maybe that they'll be better on the penalty kill. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what his role is going to be, but good for you, Manny. You left the worst city in Canada and came to the best city in Canada. So there you go, buddy. How about it?
The reverse DJ Smith, some might call it. That's honestly all I could think of. As you're saying, you should judge an assistant by how the fan base feels when he leaves. Boy, we were sending some heartbroken texts when DJ Smith left Mike Babcock's bench a couple years ago. And hey, I don't know that that's been the barn burner of success that the Sens would have asked. Not that that's his fault. Boffo, great job by you tonight. Thank you so much for putting
Thanks,
this program
buddy.
Together. Great job for the buffet. Always nice to get a little snack right before bed.
I agree, guys. Always love that midnight snack. Thanks.
There he goes, producer Mark Boffel. I want to thank everybody who joined us. Again, everybody, just two people, Kevin Barker and Drew Stoltz at The Sleazy Man on Twitter. Love, love, love getting to do the show with you, McKee. I'm sure there'll be a little more NFL next time we talk. When we stop talking, it'll be time for A Kick in the Grass. Jeff Blair and Kevin Barker will have you covered on all that. Of course, if you're listening to the station, you want to know what's on tomorrow. Good show will be on the air, 9 just after leadoff. That has Ziggy and Scott MacArthur starting things off. This has been Sportsnet Tonight. Sam McKee and Brent Gunning, thank you for listening.